Deserts are dead, or so they appear to the casual observer, but to the careful analyst of the desert, it is found to be a place of beauty and of life, so that there grow delicate flowers and hardy cacti. There are underground streams of water. There is a surprising amount of animal life. Some of you may remember now what's got to be a lot of years ago when the Walt Disney Studios put out a film called The Living Desert, and that was the theme of that film, a film that showed at first glance that it was a place of sand and lifelessness. But upon careful analysis, there was all kinds of animal life, there was all types of activity, there was all types of plant life growing. It was, in fact, a place far more of life than of lifelessness. Now, that's not to say, of course, that deserts are not different, because they are. The rules for survival are quite different in a desert than in a jungle. The rules are different, and survival is difficult, and growth is extraordinarily, often painfully slow. But that doesn't mean that we should write off deserts. We should not just think of them as a necessary evil, dry places in an otherwise wet planet. We shouldn't think of them merely as some distances that must be traveled in order to get on to a far better destination. But rather, we ought to discover, as did the Hebrew people here in Exodus 15, that deserts are for growing. Now, they discovered that through three changes which God taught them in these final paragraphs of Exodus 15. The first change was from miracle to misery. The Hebrew people had just experienced the premier miracle of the entire Old Testament. They had experienced God miraculously delivering them from slavery in Egypt to freedom on their way to the Promised Land. Now, you may think that compared to some other things that God did in the Old Testament, this is not the premier miracle. You would say probably that the premier miracle was the creation of the universe. And indeed, it is far more spectacular than moving a relatively small group of people from one geographical place to another. Or you might argue that some of the things that were done in the days of Elijah and Elisha or some other period of Old Testament history were in fact more spectacular and significant than that which we have studied here in the Old Testament book of Exodus. But that is not the way the Old Testament and even the New Testament authors saw it. When they pointed back to God's great demonstration of his loveness, of his love and his goodness and his redemption, they pointed back not to creation, nor to the days of Elijah and Elisha, but almost invariably pointed back to the Exodus, to the events of those 10 plagues when God supernaturally afflicted the Egyptians and supernaturally preserved the Hebrews, to the amazing feat of moving a large group of people across the territory and into freedom, where God cut a dry swath through an otherwise wet reed sea, when God amazingly drowned an army that was hostile and ready to conquer them, when God led them step by step away from what should be the normal route to the north to the unusual route to the south, and so preserved them from panic and returning to slavery in Egypt. All of those things made for, in Hebrew history, the miracle of miracles. Having experienced that, seen it firsthand, been there, it is no wonder that the first 21 verses of Exodus 15 are verses of praise and adoration, of celebration and exaltation. It's no wonder that they shouted and that they sang, that they celebrated, that they danced, that they played their instruments, all of these things because they had experienced the premier miracle of all of Old Testament times. But you know, miracles are not normal experiences. Miracles are not for every day, or they would not be miracles. If they were the norm, then that would defy the very definition of what a miracle is. A miracle is, by definition, something which is unusual, something which is exceptional. In fact, while we may mistakenly talk about and think about the Bible as a book full of miracles, the truth of it is that the Bible has comparatively few miracles, at least in terms of its volume and time and words. Those of us who attempt every year to read through the entire Bible from Genesis to Revelation, were we to count the days, we'd discover that there are many days when we read passage after passage, chapter after chapter, and there is no miracle. Or at best, there is an allusion to some miracle that is long ago or is yet to come. The fact is that miracles are few and far between. There are a few periods here, and Exodus is one of them, in the times of Elijah and Elisha is another, in the days of Jesus Christ and his earthly ministry is another. But most of the Bible and most of the time are empty of miracles. And so it is for us. Most of our lives and most of our time is not filled with miracles. We might wish it that way. We might think it would be better if 7 days a week would bring at least 7 miracles a week. But the fact is that most of us have experienced few, if any, miracles in our lives. There may have been a moment when we were delivered from some real or figurative slavery, when we, by God's grace, walked, we might think, supernaturally across an otherwise uncrossable sea, when we have had an encounter with God that has left its imprint and its memory upon us, when we have conquered our enemies. Yes, we may have a few of those things, or some of us may have none of those things. Understand that the norm is no miracles, and that miracles are really the exception, at least as far as Scripture is concerned, and probably as far as most of our lives are concerned. Now, that makes what here happened all the more spectacular. These miracles that had just passed, they were great, phenomenal, fantastic. Come up with any superlative you can. Absolutely wonderful. But according to Exodus 15:22, it took only 3 days for the Hebrews to change from the ecstasy of miracles to the agony of miseries. There they were in the desert of Shur, in the northwest corner of the Sinai wilderness or peninsula, and out of water. They were at least thinking about the fact that they might die. At least in Egypt, they had had something to drink. And here, they were going to die slowly, miserably. In 3 days, they could not have traveled terribly far. They had children with them. They had the elderly with them. They had livestock with them. They had brought some things along to eat and drink. But when you analyze it, you discover that food is easier to carry than water. Water's heavy, 62.4 pounds per cubic foot. And water, in fact, is far more necessary for survival. It is possible under normal circumstances for a human being to live a month without food, but only a week without water. Those who analyze these things tell us that the average human body needs 2.5 quarts of water a day just to survive. 2.5 quarts. Now, in America, we use an average of 70 gallons a day. Now, we don't drink all of that, but by the time we wash our dishes and take our showers and do all of those other things, we, I suppose, of all the people in the world, are the most prolific users of water. But we're talking about just survival, 2.5 quarts each. But multiply that out times 3 days, and multiply that out by a minimum of 600,000, and some would say as many as 3 million people, and you would find that it would be logistically impossible to carry that much water for them to survive. So there they were in the desert, dying, running out of water, thirsty, miserable, frightened, dehydrated, until someone saw some water. You can imagine the excitement that spread through the ranks. You can hear the good news being spoken. You can picture happy people just running, breaking away from the crowds. Thirsty people making it to the water, running as fast as they could, hoping to bring it back to their babies, to their livestock. At last, something to drink. I think that we can, maybe not physically, but figuratively, kind of identify with that. Because there have been times in our own experiences when we have been trekking in the desert, and at best we have not had a miracle for a long time. And we're hungry and thirsty, and maybe even dying, just absolutely miserable. And we see hope. Hope. You know, you've been lonely, desperately lonely. No one cares. No one even knows you're alive. And then the telephone rings, the first time it has rung in who knows how long, and it's an invitation to go out to dinner, to be with someone, to have company. Or you've been unemployed, And you've been desperate for money and for a job. And you've tried every alternative you could possibly come up with. And then an interview. An appointment is made. There's hope. There's water. You're going to make it. Or you've been ill. And all of the doctors that you have seen have said that really there is nothing that can be done, that you must live with your illness until the day you die, and it may come sooner because of your illness than it would otherwise. And then another physician says, yet there is a drug that is being used in your type of case, and it has had a certain measure of success, and we'll give it a try. And you come home elated because you've seen hope. You've seen water. You've seen that things are going to be okay after all. And so those people must have run to the waters of Marah, happy, delighted, some of them reaching in and scooping up the water to their mouths, others not taking the time, just lapping it right up as fast as they could. And still others not even waiting to do that, they just dove straight on in to the shallow waters of Marah, only to find that they were bitter. They gagged and coughed and spit out the water. It was so loaded with minerals. It was so horrible tasting that they couldn't even keep it in their mouths. I'm not sure which is worse, living with misery or having hope that turns out not to be hope at all. Hope disappointed in itself is a crushing blow. And it would seem at least that it might be better never to have hopes raised than to have them so dashed. Israel as a nation was miserable and disappointed. And misery led to complaint. The Bible says that they murmured against Moses, and that's true, but that really hides something far deeper, and that is that in truth they were complaining against God. Moses was only a convenient target. Their grumbles were really aimed at Yahweh. Now, had they forgotten just 3 days earlier? Had they forgotten the tune that they were singing? Had they forgotten the timbrels that they were sounding? Had they forgotten the dances that they were giving before God in celebration and worship? Had they forgotten the miracle past? Did they not remember that God had delivered them from the mighty hand of Pharaoh? Did they not recall that they had walked with their own feet on dry ground in the Reed Sea? Didn't they not remember that with their own eyes they had seen the Egyptian army drown and die, and so they had been delivered? Had they forgotten all of these things just because now they were thirsty? Apparently so. And us? Well, we too are easily turned from celebration to complaint when our miracles run out and our miseries multiply. And it is then that we are tempted to grumble and complain against others or the circumstances, but in truth to grumble against God. And so it is no wonder that 1,500 years later, the Apostle Paul had to write to the Philippians in Philippians 2:14 to do all things without grumbling, even trek through a waterless desert. You see, God wants us to grow. He wants us to bloom even in our dry times and even in our desert places. And hear this well, grumblers don't grow. If you're grumbling right now about your desert experience, I'll tell you, you're not growing spiritually. And if you're growing spiritually, I'll tell you, you haven't been grumbling. Deserts are for growing, and grumblers don't grow. That is a second change that God used to grow them in the desert. It's in just the first half of the 25th verse. It's the change from sour to sweet. You see, God was not insensitive to their needs. Although it's interesting that God intervenes in response to Moses' prayer and not in response to the people's complaints. We ought to remember that when we are about our complaining. Yahweh God, the Lord, had made the desert. Of course he had, because he had made all the world, and he had made its water, and so he was the one who knew what to do. Moses cried to the Lord, verse 25 says, and the Lord showed him a tree. Now we need to try to understand what all was happening here. Apparently, Mara, which is the Hebrew word for bitter, Mara was a place where the water was artesian water that was loaded with minerals that had bubbled out of the ground, and so it tasted terrible. There are similar places in the Sinai wilderness to this day. Now traveling there, it is only a sparsely populated place, there are Arabs and particularly nomads who have learned what to do with that water. Typically, they take a barberry bush and they take the leaves and the branches and they put it in the water. And the aromatic flavor and smell of that barberry bush are sufficient to overpower the minerals of the artesian water and so make it palatable. Perhaps then it was somewhat similar back then, that God pointed out to Moses a tree. That seems so mundane, it almost seems strange and embarrassing to say, but a tree. And Moses cut down the tree, and he threw the whole thing into the waters of Marah. And God then, supernaturally, to be sure, used the natural, the tree, in order to change the sour waters to sweet. Now, there's some hidden lessons that are tucked into the words and almost between the lines of this half verse. For example, the Hebrew word that is translated in our English Bible as showed is the root for the word Torah. Now, if you know a little bit about the Old Testament or you have a Jewish friend who has studied the Old Testament law, you have heard your Jewish friend refer to the Torah because that is the Hebrew word for law. Now, typically, I at least, tend to think of law as that which is restrictive, that which tells me what I cannot do, and it is, at least we are tempted to think of it, as somewhat of a negative term. Many people think of that as far as the Bible is concerned, that God has his laws, and that's negative, that God is trying to somehow crimp our styles. Well, actually, the word law or Torah means showed. God Torah'd him a tree. God showed him a tree. So law or instruction is to enable us to survive in the desert and to change the sour waters to sweet. Law is not something that is bad, something that is restrictive, at least not when it comes from God, but rather it is simply God showing us, God guiding us so that we can survive and in fact survive well. Another interesting lesson that I find here is that God used a tree. And so we find a principle that is oftentimes repeated here in Exodus, that God uses the natural and the commonplace supernaturally and in an uncommon way. He does that with us too, of course. God often uses the ordinary things to change the sour things of our lives to sweet. Perhaps a tree. Perhaps a song. Perhaps a friend. Perhaps a book. Perhaps a sermon. Perhaps something we hear on the radio, or something we see on a billboard, or some scrap of paper left around the house, or a word long forgotten that flashes back upon the screen of our minds. God takes the ordinary and magnifies it extraordinarily until he uses that to change our lives from sour to sweet. Unfortunately, too often we are looking for the spectacular. Too often we are waiting for the amazing changes to take place. You know the old adage about not being able to see the tree for the forest or the forest for the trees. Well, often that is the way it is with us, that there God would use some ordinary tree that we have taken for granted because all we think it is one more part of the forest, but in fact it is that instrument which God seeks to use in our lives to accomplish the transformation from sourness to sweetness. The Lord shows, and the rest of the first part of verse 25, the Lord sweetens. Moses threw the tree into the water, and the water became sweet. Now, if this worked the way modern Arabs sweeten mineral waters with bayberry bushes, then the effect must have been, of course, amazingly, miraculously multiplied out by God. I find here a fascinating formula, though. I find that God did not subtract the bitterness, but rather that he added the sweetness. When we are in our deserts, typically we seek the subtraction of that which is bitter. And so we say, God, I have all these bills, take them away. Or we say, God, oh, he is an irritation to me. Couldn't you transfer him to Pango Pango or some other suburb a long ways away? Or, God, this car is just absolutely driving me crazy. I mean, how can, a 1987 Lamborghini not start in the morning after I have spent all this money? God, take away the bitterness. Take away the difficulty. And God, instead of using the arithmetic of subtraction, uses the arithmetic of addition. And so instead of subtracting the difficult and bitter out of our lives, he instead adds the sweet. And the sweet overpowers the bitter without having to take it away. But I find most interesting of all of the factors of this story comes at the very end, actually sort of a PS at the end of the chapter. Verse 27 says that then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they encamped there by the water. Now, archaeologists and geographers have figured out where these places are, or were. Mara, the ancient Mara that's referred to here in Exodus 15, is in Arabic now called the place, the modern place of Ein Hawara. And Elim is the place that is now called the Wadi Garandel. Now, what's particularly fascinating is they're only 7 miles apart. The bitter waters of Mara are 7 miles north of the sweet waters of Elim. Meaning, then, that God did not have to there perform a miracle, nor was it geographically necessary to take them through all of the experience that they had there with their hopes dashed and the bitter taste in their mouths. God could have simply taken them down the road a few more hours' travel, 7 miles to Elim, and there they had a dozen fountains to drink from. There they even had 70 palm trees to give them shade while they drank the cool water and had their needs met. But he didn't do it. Instead, God kept them away from the sweet waters of Elim and kept them at the bitter waters of Mara. You know, he could have done it so differently. Why? Why did he do it the way he did? Because he wanted to grow them in the desert. They would not have grown as God intended for them if they had gone right to Elim. And God often does the same for us. He delays us at Mara. Sometimes he keeps us there an extraordinarily long time so that there we can see his miracles, so that there we can experience his power, so that there we can know God in his truth in a way that we would never know him, never experience him, never see him if we went 7 miles farther just to the sweet waters of Elim. So don't grumble. Don't complain. But grow. Grow in your desert and experience God at your Mara. Now there is a third change that is given to us here in Exodus 15 as God seeks to grow these people in the desert. It's in verses 25 and 26. It's the change from proving to promise. The end of verse 25 tells us in part that there at Mara, he proved them. Proved them. That means he tested them. Now, the purpose of testing is to demonstrate quality. So if a test pilot takes a prototype of an airplane and flies it, it is obviously not with the expectation to prove that it isn't a very good plane so that he can crash and die. It is obviously just the opposite. The test pilot seeks to prove that it is a good plane and that he can fly it and live. Certain pieces of machinery have on them test buttons. We have some around this building that you keep your hands off, but I occasionally push. If you look in the lower level of this building, where there aren't windows, like in the hallways, we have, which the code requires, these emergency lights. They're battery packs that are continually charged with the flow of electricity, and then on them are what look like two car headlights. And the idea is that if there's a power failure in the building or in the city, and people are down there when that happens, that these lights will automatically come on, so there will be sufficient light for people to exit the building. However, how do you know if they're going to work when the time comes? Well, you have to test them. And so there's a button on there, and I take care of it, so you don't. As I walk by, when other people aren't around, I push the button, see if the lights will come on. And they come on.
So that's what a test button is for. A test pilot, a test button. The purpose of testing, of proving, is to see that it works. More than that, it's to confirm what you already think you know, but you want to make sure and you want to demonstrate it. And so it was that Marah was the testing ground, the proving ground for the nation of Israel. God had redeemed them, God had empowered them, God had given them marvelous gifts and miracles. But here it was to be demonstrated that they, in fact, were loyal to God and that God was, in fact, trustworthy. Now listen, that same God tests and proves us in our deserts, at our Marahs. He never does it with the purpose of failure. He always does it with the purpose of success. But understand that it is not enough for us to comfortably sit in a church service on a Sunday morning and hear claim to be Christians who know Jesus Christ and depend upon the power of the Holy Spirit. No, no. It must be tested and proved. Where our Christianity really shows is seldom in a worship service on a Sunday morning when we sing our hymns, are dressed so nicely, and seated so comfortably. Where it shows is where we are tested. It's at home, at the kitchen table. It's at work, at the desk. It's while we're traveling on the airplane and they're in some distant airport. It's when things go wrong. It's when the waters are bitter rather than sweet. It is then that we are tested. And it is then that God seeks to demonstrate in our lives to us and to all around us that we are what we claim to be and what he has made us to be. Now, don't be discouraged by the Lord's proving. Don't be discouraged by his testing. It has marvelously good results. For therein is it demonstrated that we are all that God has sought to make us. Then our doubts are chased away and our confidence grows as we are tested and proved to be the real thing. I think of a conversation I had not too long ago with a man who had a terrible phobia of death. I mean, it was an obsession with him, to the point where he thought about it most of the time, where he was frightened to do many of the ordinary things of life. He was petrified at the prospect of getting a germ or a virus, and it was immobilizing his entire life. And then God tested him by almost killing him. And so he found himself no longer just thinking about death, but dying. And there on the very brink of the grave, God preserved him, and God demonstrated his grace, and he recovered. It was then by his own testimony that he said, and still says, that he had no longer fears death. He's no longer afraid of dying, because he's been there. He's been there, and he's experienced God's grace and God's goodness. He's been tested. He's been proved. And he passed. By God's grace, he passed. And so life now is qualitatively something it never could have been if he had not himself traveled by the bitter waters of Marah in the desert, in his case, called death. Verse 26 tells us that God changes the proving to promising. It is here that he tells us that if you will diligently hearken to the voice of the Lord your God and do that which is right in his eyes and give heed to his commandments and keep all his statutes, then I will put none of the diseases upon you which I put upon the Egyptians, for I am the Lord your healer. Yahweh changes proving to promise. So here it is that he promises that he will reward obedience with protection, that those who hear his voice and obey it will never suffer the plagues, the consequences of his judgment upon sin. And instead, a bit of Hebrew here, instead he will be to them a God called Yahweh Rophe, R-O-P-H-E, the Lord who heals. What a promise, protection and healing. And what a truth that obedience reaps rewards. Hey, what if they had never traveled in the desert? What if they had taken the northern route? What if they had taken the typical caravan path? What if they had never stopped at Marah? Well, if none of those things had taken place, then Israel never would have tasted of the sweetness of God, nor never would have heard of God's promise. You see, for them, like for us, deserts are for growing. Now, as we leave this chapter, there's something we have to take note of. I'm sure those people thought that their journey in the desert would be probably weeks or at most months. Never did they dream that it would take 40 years to get a couple of hundred miles from Egypt to Canaan. Never did they imagine that most of them would live most of their lives in the desert wilderness of Sinai. 40 years, and in those days, 40 years was greater than the life expectancy of most of the people, the average citizen. And so it was that for them, it was either grow in the desert or don't grow at all, because the desert was where they spent their lives. There must have been some who decided, I'll wait until I get to Canaan. I'll wait until I get to the promised land. And when I have arrived, then I will grow spiritually. And then I will bloom for God. And those that thought that died in the wilderness. They shriveled and never grew. They never grew because they didn't grow in the desert. And that was the only place they had to grow. Now, I hope this does not sound terribly pessimistic to you, but frankly, most of our lives are lived in the deserts. We try to imagine it other ways, but it is not true. Most of our lives are lived in the deserts. We don't usually call it the desert of Sinai, but they're very real deserts. Yours may be called the desert of loneliness, or the desert of divorce, or the desert of depression, or the desert of unemployment or underemployment, or the desert of some other name that readily you can speak. If you are waiting until the desert journey is over, until you've arrived in the promised land, and then you're going to bloom, and then you're going to grow, the chances are that that is a decision not to grow at all. Deserts are for growing. You see, like the people of Israel, we must choose what to do with our deserts. We must choose to grumble or to grow. And it is God who says,